The judicial power shall extend in all cases in law and equity arising under the Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority. That's from the Constitution of the United States. This is from a recent newspaper headline. Supreme Court clears the way for mass firings at federal agencies. And that is just one of many, many, I would say, an unprecedented number of, let's say, statements by the Supreme Court, if not downright decisions. And we are going to find out exactly what is the prospect of the Supreme Court in these particular situations. The U.S. Constitution does establish what the Supreme Court has the power to rule on, but recently the Supreme Court has chosen not to rule on a variety of major cases that fall under its jurisdiction. And what's the significance of that inaction? And is there a pattern to it? I'm Norman Gilliland, and with me is Howard Schwaber, professor of political science at the UW-Madison. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much for having me.
Welcome back, I should say. Fortunately for us, a frequent guest.
Have been.
Virtually every day, Howard, we see in the online edition of the New York Times a story, a breaking news headline about the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, saying one thing or another, and often what shall we say, muted decision or pronouncement. What's going on? I don't remember this from even a couple of years ago.
You are not wrong. This was not happening a couple of years ago. It is unprecedented, a term that's singularly appropriate in this context. So to back up a little bit, since Trump has taken office this time, there have been, again, I'll use the word, unprecedented numbers of court orders telling him he can't do X or he can't do Y. Now, if you're Trump, the explanation is that the judges are monsters who hate America. That's a quote. And various other things that he said about judges across the country being radicals and so on, including some whom he appointed. You may recall a little while ago, he criticized the Federalist Society by claiming they had persuaded him to take on judges who weren't really on his side as much as he would like. So one theory is that these are judges that are out of control. The other theory, which judges would say, is that no, the Trump administration is, if not out of control, at least engaged in an extraordinarily radical series of actions through an enormous number of executive orders that are simply unlike anything any administration has ever done before, including the first Trump administration. So that's the setup. Now, two things to say about that. I don't think it's too strong to describe the Trump administration as fundamentally lawless. And I mean that in two very distinct ways. First, quite frequently, the Trump administration, and let's be clear, very often Trump himself says things in ways that are, how shall I phrase this, more colorful, less specific, and not as well worked out as the people around, as the way the people around him might say the same thing to explain what's going on. So I can't say that Trump takes this position clearly himself, but the people around him take the position very clearly that Trump is entitled to ignore federal laws that he deems to be unconstitutional constraints on the president.
But isn't that the job of the Supreme Court to determine what laws are constitutional and what aren't?
You might think so. Now, there is a longstanding theory called departmentalism that says each branch of the federal government should have equal authority to determine whether laws are constitutional or not. We haven't really practiced that since approximately 1796 and possibly earlier. I'm thinking of a very particular case, and certainly since 1803, the case Marbury versus Madison that everybody knows. The theory does pop its head up occasionally, but we have never, as far as I know, had a president who made a general practice of saying, if I think a federal law is unconstitutional in the way that it restricts my authority, I can simply ignore it unless and until the Supreme Court says otherwise. And one thing that Trump has been very clear about, he himself, is saying, well, of course, if the Supreme Court said we can't do this, we'd stop. It's the lower courts he feels free to ignore, and the Congress. So that's one piece of why I call this lawless, because this is an administration that quite literally declares, quite publicly and literally declares, they're not obliged to follow the law. The other way in which this administration is lawless is, I sort of already alluded to this, the way in which they feel free to ignore or avoid or evade orders from federal judges. And that record is really quite extraordinary. I'm sure everybody listening, you know, is familiar with at least some of these instances. The planes in the air ordered to be turned back, and the administration saying first, no, they're out of our airspace, and then saying, oh, well, the order wasn't written down, so we didn't think we had to follow it, and then saying, oh, well, it's too late. The pattern of evasion, prevarication, and outright defiance of otherwise legitimate orders from federal judges has been extraordinary. So you have an administration that I won't say is pushing the bounds, has burst right through the bounds of what counts as legal and lawful. And so in that sense, they're a deeply, profoundly lawless administration. Here's what happens next. And it often sounds technical when you hear about injunctions and stays and orders removing a stay or orders imposing a stay. It's actually really simple. The terminology is complex. The process is simple. Trump does something that somebody thinks is bad, firing a lot of federal employees who are protected by federal statutes, deporting people without adequate due process, ignoring federal laws, an example I just mentioned, declining to spend money that's been allocated by Congress, closing departments that have been funded by Congress. Pick your choice. He does something that somebody says, wait, this is illegal or unconstitutional. They go to court. A federal judge says, you're right, this is illegal or unconstitutional, and orders the Trump administration to stop it. That's an injunction. Then the Trump administration goes to a court of appeals, which either says, yes, the lower court was right, Trump administration should have stopped doing this, or they say the lower court was wrong, feel free to go about your business. Regardless, the losing party then appeals to the Supreme Court. So the questions that have been reaching the Supreme Court have two halves, two pieces, and this has happened over and over and over, including in every one of the instances that I just mentioned. First, is this thing the Trump administration is doing allowed? Does it violate the Constitution, pardon me, or does it violate the law? To answer those two questions, you may have to answer the question, is the statute in question itself constitutional? Or a question about the scope of executive authority. The second part of the question is, oh, there's this injunction in place, or it's been removed, you know, should the federal government be prevented from acting in this possibly illegal or unconstitutional way while we figure this out?
Is that standard?
That is absolutely standard. It's absolutely standard to have an injunction imposed. If the reviewing court thinks there's a pretty good chance that the party that got the injunction will succeed on the merits when they finally get to the real question, then it's standard practice to leave the injunction in place. But it can be a separate question. You can say, if you're the Supreme Court, yes, this injunction may stand and the federal government has to stop what it's doing, or no, the injunction does not stand and the federal government can go back to doing what it wanted to do. And we're not going to decide today whether that thing that they're doing is illegal or unconstitutional or not.
Do you ever have the sense that these decisions are not necessarily the Trump administration, but certainly, as you've said, Howard, they have the lion's share of these situations. Do you ever have the sense that they're just doing whatever it is and then trying to figure out a rationale for it after the fact when it's challenged?
The Trump administration? Absolutely. And the rationales sometimes keep changing. But we should not overlook, if you go back to the Project 2025 document, they got a lot of attention during the campaign, and rightly so. Russell Vought, who is a key author of that document, is now the director of federal operations, and is playing a big role. You know, there was a very distinct vision, and this actually goes back further. There's a distinct vision that's gone back to the 80s of undoing the administrative state, of rolling back the independence of agencies, of expanding the authority of the executive, of limiting the power of Congress to restrain the executive. These are long-term conservative constitutional goals that are part of a very large, very important constitutional revolution that we've been seeing going on for at least, well, it started in the 80s, but certainly in the Roberts Court in the last 10 years. And, you know, in the last 10 years or so from the Roberts Court, we've gotten used to seeing big things, big radical changes. Everyone knows about the abortion case and the guns case, but there have been others that are arguably more important, or at least as important, reducing the independence of executive agencies, expanding what's called the theory of the unitary executive, that is the president's control over operations of putatively independent parts of the government, expanding the authority of courts to second-guess agencies. So this was called deference. Should courts defer to experts and agencies on questions of policy or questions of law? And the Roberts Court has pushed in the direction of saying no. So that's all been a part of a broad and fairly dramatic constitutional change. I used the term constitutional revolution. I think it's getting to the point of qualifying for that. That's a long-term thing. That's a long story. It's been building for a long time. We've seen this from the Roberts Court for years. What's happening this year is different. What's happening this year is the Trump administration, I don't know how else to put this, going rogue is the shortest way I can phrase it. It's in the same general direction as these changes, these constitutional changes I've been describing, a more unitary executive, a less independent agency system. But it's far, far beyond anything anyone's ever seen before, to the point of, as I said before, lawlessness, which creates a genuine crisis.
Constitutional crisis.
Well, see, that's a phrase people like, and that is the question, because what many people have said, okay, including me, you know, is that this would reach the stage of being a constitutional crisis if the Supreme Court said stop and the administration said we don't care what you say. Somehow that would be, you know, the tripwire, the final line.
But you're saying that Trump has said that he is not interested, not likely, not at this point wanting to take issue with a Supreme Court decision in terms of disregarding it.
Well, he's said that. But here's the thing. The main story of our main point in this discussion is the way the Supreme Court has refused to rule on the underlying question of whether the Trump administration's actions are constitutional or legal. They haven't said they are. They haven't said they aren't. They've said, we're not deciding that today. We'll get back to it next year, maybe the year after. But in the meantime, the Trump administration can keep doing what it can keep deporting people without due process or to third countries. It can keep firing people in violation of federal statutes. It can keep ignoring federal laws. It can keep shutting down agencies. It can keep doing all the things that it wants to do that we might later decide are illegal. But until you make that decision, we're not going to let the courts stop him from doing it. And that's what reached ahead in the case most recently involving universal injunctions.
Let's pull one of those threads then. That's due process.
Well, actually, given the way the thing has played out, let me suggest that we talk about birthright citizenship, because it's a really perfect illustration. It's a really perfect illustration of what's going on. Donald Trump issued an executive order saying, effectively, birthright citizenship, which is contained in the 14th Amendment, is revoked. Starting 30 days after this order takes effect, any child born to someone who is here either unlawfully or temporarily is not a U.S. citizen.
Isn't it? It's a short statement in the 14th Amendment. Isn't it quite clear?
You would think, many people thought for a very long time that it was, including every court that has ever considered the question. There's a line that says, born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Before now, that's not entirely true. If you go back to a case from before World War I, there was a hint of this before. But generally speaking, that has been understood to mean for example, the children of born to ambassadors, foreign ambassadors.
Who would have allegiance to a foreign country by definition.
Not just allegiance, they're not subject to American law.
Which has created many an interesting situation,
yes, it has.
Hasn't it?
To take one trivial example, foreign embassies parking tickets in New York City. Sometimes have reached the point of being a crisis for that city. I'm not making that up. The Trump administration takes the position that anyone who, in their view, is likely to be loyal to a government out of the United States should be denied citizenship. And it is their view that anyone who is here illegally or temporarily fits that description. All right. No one's ever had this theory before. It's an extraordinarily radical theory. It's extraordinarily radical for a president to declare the authority to interpret the 14th Amendment that way and effectively change existing federal naturalization law. The Constitution says the rules of naturalization are up to Congress, very specifically. And the Constitution, of course, says that the interpretation of the 14th Amendment, among other things, is up to the courts. So all kinds of reasons for thinking that this is a very, very questionable move. Beyond the authority of the president, unconstitutional in the first place, or just plain wrong in its interpretation. Lots of reasons to think that this is likely to be, and most people I know think that if this question ever reaches the Supreme Court, they're likely to rule against him. So that's the setup. The case finally reaches the U.S. Supreme Court, right, just the last couple of weeks. Trump versus Casa, it's called. And the court declines to rule on the question. They simply do not rule on whether the executive, on whether the president has the authority to alter the meaning of birthright citizenship or not. What they rule on is the question of injunctions. And they say the lower court that issued an injunction, that is an order telling the Trump administration, you cannot deny people birthright citizenship. I mean, the meaning of that order is this executive order doesn't take effect. You can't treat people as non-citizens for purposes of benefits. You can't treat people as non-citizens for various legal persons, including, I mean, specifically these babies who are born to parents who are here temporarily or unlawfully. The court says, no, the lower courts can't issue injunctions that bind the entire federal government. So an injunction is an order to a party. If the party is the federal government and the rule is, dear federal government, stop doing X, you'd kind of think it's just makes sense. That means the federal government has to stop doing X everywhere. The order was not stop doing X in Madison, Wisconsin. You order a party to do or not do a thing. And if the party is the federal government, they're national actors. For decades, Democrats and Republicans have chafed at this power of lower court judges. If you think about, for example, Obamacare, when a lower court judge in Texas issued an injunction to stop it. Just to take one example, Medicaid expansion is another. So both Republican and Democratic presidents have been upset by this power of lower court judges.
We're seeing much more, and it's inevitable, I suppose, many more judgments from the lower courts, at least in the news.
Well, this goes back to where I started, right? Either that's because the lower court judges are all crazy, including the ones appointed by Trump, or it's because the Trump administration is doing really wild things at a remarkable number of instances. So the Supreme Court said you can't have universal injunctions. You can only have injunctions that apply to the particular individuals in front of you. So in this case, the particular parents of children who had been born. You can't, and you can tell the federal government that in your jurisdiction, you, the lower court, federal court judge, you can't do X, but you can't say you can't do X all over the country. That's what they ruled on. That means, but they didn't rule on the question of the executive order ending birthright citizenship, which means birthright citizenship is ended in the United States unless you have a federal judge who, with respect to you individually, says, yep, federal government cannot deny this person's birthright citizenship. And they said this not because they're ruling that it's constitutional or legal, but because they are declining to rule on the question until some unstated date in the future, almost certainly at the earliest next term. So between now and then, very large numbers of children born under these circumstances that I've described will be treated as non-U.S. citizens.
Unless they apply successfully individually.
Individually or in what's called a class action suit.
Oh, sure.
Which is the next step in this process. This would take a whole additional show, I think, to really explain. But the short version is a class action suit is a way for a lot of people to seek a relief all at once. But there are really strict limitations on how you can form a class. In fact, here's the speed at which things are going these days. A judge has already approved a class action suit and defined the class as all babies born who would be subject to this executive order. The Trump administration has said, no, you can't do that. Because, you know, and their position is there's a big difference between someone who is born while their mother is visiting for the weekend and someone who's born while their mother has been living here for 25 years and someone who's not born yet who would be covered by this by the results of this lawsuit.
Now we're getting into the logical argument of the beard, aren't we? How many days living in this country does it take to...
Absolutely. And the context which we're having this argument is the very cumbersome, very technical, very complicated process of it is called certifying a class action. And the reason we're having to have that conversation is because the Supreme Court said judges cannot tell the United States government, stop doing this thing. We think it's probable that it's unconstitutional. But on the other hand, we're not going to tell you whether it is in fact unconstitutional. And this has happened over and over and over this term. The Supreme Court, on every single one of the major issues I mentioned at the outset, firing employees, deporting people without due process or to unrelated third countries, evading federal judges' orders, moving people around, all the various Well, it depends if you approve or disapprove of them. But if you disapprove of these things, the dirty tricks that the Trump administration has been pulling in every, I think every single one that I can think of, the Supreme Court has refused to rule on whether the Trump administration or Trump himself can actually do those things. They've only ruled that courts can't stop them until we, the Supreme Court, decide to get around to answering the bigger question. And we're not doing that this year.
We're going to look further at this phenomenon of the Supreme Court in the second Trump administration in particular, and some aspects to it, and also perhaps what's really behind it, if anything. Is there a significant, meaningful pattern, or is it just a matter of convenience? When we return in a moment, this is University of the Year. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, and we're looking at the Roberts Court during this conversation of University of the Year. There are a couple of, I'll call them details, but they could be very important if you're caught up in them, that we have alluded to so far. One is, we're talking about the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, punting or deferring a decision for until some unspecified period of time. What if there is a need for an immediate response?
It's a great question. And let's go back to one of the examples we were talking about, deportation without due process. If you recall, in the case of the guy who's now on trial in Virginia, who was sent to El Salvador, he and a group of other Venezuelans were in a plane in the air. And the judge, his name is Boasberg, said, turn the plane around. And the Trump administration refused to do it. You would think that that's an example of a situation where immediate action is required.
Yes.
We also have cases of people being sent to South Sudan.
Who are not citizens.
Well, who have no connection to South Sudan, which is one of the most dangerous places on earth. The Trump administration won't let Americans go there, but they'll dump people there. It's without any opportunity for them to present evidence that they face the likelihood of torture or being killed if they're sent there, right? So the point is, many of these instances involve what lawyers like to call irreparable harms. I'm trying to speak about this in a calm, professional way, but let's be clear what the Supreme Court is saying. You can keep sending people to places where they will be killed or tortured until we decide to answer the question whether you're allowed to do that or not.
Maybe in another year or two.
That takes 6 months or a year or 2 years. In the interim, we will not let judges stop you. You can keep doing what you're doing.
Which seems problematic for a Supreme Court.
Boy, does it ever. So, you know, during the break, actually, you raised the question. I'm sorry to jump on your line, but you said, would this whole story be different if the Trump administration started locking up citizens without due process? You know, and that's the point at which, I mean, critics of the Trump administration, I have to be honest, can get a little bit alarmist.
Occasionally. A little shrill.
A little, occasionally. And, you know, you've heard a lot of throwing around the F word, fascist. Of course, this is not a fascist state, but imagine.
That's the F word, by the way.
That's the F word that I had in mind, you know. But imagine if things get much worse, and let's not worry about the meaning of that term, but imagine if Trump started locking up political opponents who are citizens, locked up the Democratic National Committee without a trial. All right, what would happen? Well, the answer is someone would go to court and say, hey, he can't do that, judge. Issue an injunction. And the judge could issue an injunction as to those particular people. He could also bring a writ of habeas corpus, which is another way to go to a judge and ask for relief in a situation when someone is locked up without due process. But let's stick with the injunction for a moment. the judge, under the current, the ruling that the Supreme Court has just made, could issue a ruling that says you can't keep those people locked up without due process, but could not issue a ruling that says the U.S. government may not lock people up without trials.
Split it out a little bit.
Well, not just a little bit. It would have to be by each instance or class of people, and the process would result in people staying in jail for a long time while the class is certified, the class action case is heard, the proceeding goes forward. Habeas petitions have to be brought one at a time for each person who is incarcerated. If you think of the sort of horrific visions that some Trump critics conjure up, if you imagine the Trump administration locking up 100,000 people, it would be extraordinarily difficult and time-consuming.
In all ways, just locking up that many.
And you know, don't forget, the Trump administration's defense of its actions has been, we want to deport a million people. It's not possible to have trials for all and due process for all of them. That's actually their justification. We can't be required to have due process because if we were held to that requirement, it wouldn't be possible to do the thing we want to do.
That's very dark.
It is extraordinarily dark. So I have to think that, of course, if this was citizens, it would be different. I should point out that the Supreme Court has retained for itself the authority to issue universal injunctions. In fact, it issued one not that long ago against the Trump administration. And, you know, it's not hard to explain that the Supreme Court has national jurisdiction. I have to think in that situation, you know, if an emergency petition reached the court and said the Trump administration is locking up American citizens without trials, you know, this court would take action. We are not there yet. We are, however, at a really interesting potential tipping point, which is the big, beautiful bill that was just passed in Congress set aside $195 billion for ICE, immigration enforcement. That's more than the budget of the Russian military by a substantial amount. The Russian military's budget this year is about $140 billion. We've seen mass deportation before. What we have not seen before is an army created outside the ordinary military, led by people handpicked by the president for the specific purpose of carrying out the policies of an administration and no other purpose. This we have never seen before.
And usually anonymous, I mean masked?
And they're masked.
That's sad, very strange.
If you want to have dark visions of the future, I invite you to consider that as a basis. But coming back to our actual topic, thus far the Supreme Court has not been faced with that. Thus far the Supreme Court has been faced with the Trump administration running roughshod over the rights of federal employees, on the one hand, which, of course, has effects on people who depend on those activities.
Social Security, IRS, Medicaid.
That's one category. And the other category is, I would say, without hesitation, abusing the rights of immigrants, both lawful and unlawful. They're targeted. It's limited. And it's in that context that the Supreme Court has simply steadfastly refused to do what most of us think is its job, which is to call out the government when it's acting unconstitutionally and say so. And I'm kind of hoping your next question will be, why do I think they're doing that?
We promised it at the beginning, so motive.
There we go. So there are a couple of theories. And again, let me go to the dark spaces. People who like to accuse Trump of being an incipient fascist dictator and who believe in, let's call them, conspiracy theories. The conspiracy theory explanation goes like this. The Supreme Court is in the bag for Trump. They have been captured.
He appointed three of them, and who knows what other influences he has.
They are now nothing but a piece of the apparatus of an authoritarian state. After all, is both historically and currently, think of Viktor Orban in Hungary, you know, or any number of places, it is a classic move. In the move toward authoritarianism to capture the courts. I don't find this a very persuasive story. After all, if the court were really, so to speak, in the bag for Trump, they could simply rule that his actions are constitutional or are legal. That's what he wants. They're not giving him what he wants. They're just creating what I've referred to as a window of lawlessness. He gets to do whatever he wants until they decide to stop him, and they have not yet decided to stop him. It's sort of how it works. So, what is the explanation? I think the explanation is what might be called, well, Political scientists would call this institutionalism. Ordinary people might call this cowardice, which is not quite as nice a term. I think that they're hoping it will all go away. I think that they're hoping that perhaps after the midterms, perhaps the Democrats get power over one of the houses of Congress. Perhaps there's political resistance. I mean, you haven't even mentioned the question of Trump's legal authority to impose tariffs, which is another one, another category.
He's been very generous with those.
Where they've made this same move. We're not going to tell you whether he's allowed to do that or not. I think they're hoping it will go away and they will not have to answer the questions.
And what if it doesn't?
Then they have a problem. Actually, either way, in my view, they have an enormously severe problem, which was they will have allowed lawlessness to reign in this country in pretty substantial areas of public and private life for a period of months or years by their own deliberate decision not to answer a question. Now, it would be different if the majority of the court thought that everything Trump is doing is legal or is constitutional. They could say that if they believe it.
If they believed it, yeah.
Sure, they could say that. The fact that they have refused to say that suggests to me that they don't believe it. That they know they're going to have to strike down some of these things and declare them unconstitutional or illegal. They don't want to do it.
Why not?
Because they're afraid. They're afraid of Donald Trump.
Why should they be afraid? They don't have to run for office. They're in for life. They're in for, as long as they want. They're above politics of the street, I'll call it.
All of which was supposed to give federal judges and especially Supreme Court justices precisely this kind of courage. But remember that Roberts, from the very beginning, if you've followed his career in the court at all, I know you have, but if the people listening have followed, has always been very much about, well, I must preserve the dignity and authority of the court. I must prefer the independence of the court. I think he may be afraid that if he defies Trump, Trump will pack the court, add six more justices, or have him impeached, or other justices impeached, all of which has been talked about by Trump supporters.
And FDR couldn't pack it.
Nope.
But there is no prescribed number, is there, constitutionally?
There's no prescribed number. At various times, we've had six or seven, or nine, of course. There's no requirement that it be nine. Again, to be fair, it was the Democrats who were talking about packing the court.
That's right.
18 months ago? Not that long ago.
That's right.
And we're living in extraordinary times. So I think, I'm obviously speculating wildly here, but I think Roberts in particular wants to protect the court against the political consequences of taking a stand. And so he's preserving the court's moral neutrality during a time of extraordinary constitutional crisis.
There's something wrong with that picture, isn't there?
Somebody once said that the hottest circles of hell are reserved for those pursue that particular strategy. In my view, absolutely. In my view, this is more than something wrong. This is a constitutional failure. Whether it's a crisis or not, it's a failure. Congress is not, in many ways, is not limiting what Trump does because Congress supports what Trump is doing.
By a hair.
That's politics. Elections have consequences.
Thank you, Barack Obama.
You may certainly disapprove, obviously, of course, or approve. Polling data suggests as we're about evenly split in the country, slightly more disapproved than approved. Right, but in Congress's case, there's arm twisting, there's deal making, there's hardball. There always has been.
Oh, yes.
But at the end of the day, the party that controls the Congress, the Republicans, basically support what Trump wants to do. That dynamic doesn't exist with the court. The explanation for why the court is, on the one hand, not giving Trump's actions their blessing, but on the other hand, refusing to come out and refusing to stop him, has to lie somewhere other than their view of the merits of the question. That's where we get to this. I think they're trying to avoid answering the question as long as they can. And I think they really hope they will never have to answer the question. Because after all, if in 2026 the Democrats were to take control of the House of Representatives, and for example, I'm making this up, but cut all funding to ICE, right?
Sure.
Go ahead and have your army, but you can't buy them anything or pay them a salary. That's the power of the purse. That's the House's big veto power right there. If that were to happen, then presumably a lot of these questions would be moot. And there's a Supreme Court doctrine that says if a question is moot, we don't have to rule on it.
Because in other words, it doesn't really have power.
Technically, it's not a case or controversy under Article 3. Practically, it means we'll come back to this if some other president tries it in the future. The real potential for a genuine crisis is if, after the 2026 midterms, the Republicans remain in control. You know, I don't know how long this, I mean, maybe not. I don't know if the Supreme Court can go 3 years or 4 years without ruling on a single major constitutional question involving during a period in which an administration is wildly exceeding the bounds that any other prior administration's testing of the boundaries. You know, you mentioned FDR. FDR, the New Deal, started out with this incredible, gigantic thing called the National Industrial Recovery Act. Yeah. The Supreme Court ruled it was unconstitutional, and the Democrats never tried it again. After the Supreme Court ruled, the Democrats said, okay, we won't do that. We won't have a single, I mean, it was extraordinary and frankly bizarre, a single board that would control wages and prices for the entire country across all industries. It was nuts. But politically, what's important to recognize is when the court, and FDR was not fond of the court. This is what gave rise to the court packing plan. But they never, but even after the court changed its tune, the Democrats and FDR never tried to do that again.
Has the Supreme Court in this administration ruled against Trump specifically?
Once.
Just one time.
No, it's more than once. But once that really, really matters in the context that we're talking about, that's the Garcia case, the guy who was sent to El Salvador.
Which is an individual case, but also has ramifications.
Well, so this was all done before the recent ruling ending universal injunctions. So at the time, there was an injunction in place preventing sending any more Venezuelans to El Salvador. Now, the Trump people can go right back to doing that unless and until there's a successful class action lawsuit or the Supreme Court tells them to stop it. But the Garcia case is interesting because it's held up as this exemplar case, really, of the courage that the Supreme Court has shown 9-0. They wrote an opinion and it said, you must facilitate the return of Garcia. Well, first of all, facilitate is kind of a waffly word.
In what time frame?
Right? The response is, I'm sure you recall, of the Trump administration is, sorry, can't help you.
We don't even know where he is.
We don't know where he is. Only the El Salvadoran government can control this. Which is interesting because just this past week, the El Salvadoran government has filed a statement in a federal court case saying, we have no control of these people. They are here. We are merely offering prison services for the United States government. They're here under the jurisdiction of the United States. But going back to what the Supreme Court said, they said, facilitate his return. The Trump administration said, sorry, can't help you, and nothing. That was the end of it. So as a profile in courage of standing up to the Trump administration, it's not quite as ringing as you might hope. And perhaps that experience helped persuade the justices that they should stop making decisions that the Trump court doesn't like. Maybe that's part of the dynamic that got us to all the, because many of these orders have been since then.
What, did they just think it would be fruitless?
That it might be fruitless, that they would have to confront the reality of an administration that is acting lawlessly. They'd have to stop pretending it isn't happening.
They could possibly be exposed as
ineffective.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
I mean, there's a really startling element to all this that only someone who like cares about courts would care about. The Supreme Court is hanging the federal courts out to dry. And these are not, some of these are Trump-appointed judges. Some of these are very prominent conservative judges who have been long-time part of the constitutional movement I was talking about. Some of them, of course, are Obama or Biden appointees. But one thing that Roberts has always cared about deeply, and the other justices have always cared about, is protecting the autonomy, the independence, and the power of the lower federal courts. Not anymore. You have federal court judges, you know, saying, the government is lying to us. The government is ignoring our orders. The government is evading and avoiding our orders. The government is in contempt. And the Supreme Court, instead of in any other year that I can remember or have ever studied or have ever heard of, would say, look, we aren't sure that the judge is right or wrong on the case, but by golly, you've got to, you know, whoever you are, U.S. government, you've got to abide by what a federal judge says. That's our people. This Supreme Court does not have its people's backs.
We're going to look maybe a little bit more to see if there's a distinction in some of these cases, these decisions or non-decisions involving citizens versus non-citizens and the various degrees in between. When we return in a moment, this is University of the Air. I'm I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Howard Schwaber, and we're looking at, I'll call it the phenomenon, if not the decisions exactly, of the Roberts Supreme Court. And we've been looking somewhat at birthright citizenship. We've been looking at rights of the government, implied, I suppose, to deport various individuals who are, I think, non-citizens or considered to be such. But is the Trump administration making some kind of distinction in all of these cases that's ending up in the Supreme Court with?
So far, absolutely. So one of the themes that various Trump people, Pam Bondi, I mean, various administration officials, one of the themes they like to emphasize is that being here as a tourist or on a student visa or on a temporary visa or even as a permanent resident is a privilege, not a right. And we can revoke that privilege anytime it suits our purposes to do so. They're primarily relying on a very, very broadly termed law that says the Secretary of State can deport someone who's here, even on any kind of a visa, if their presence contradicts important purposes of the United States.
The United States being the administration.
Well, so first of all, yes. And since we're talking, and since the law is written in terms of foreign policy, that's pretty traditional, actually. But as I'm sure some people have noticed, in the last few weeks, the Trump administration has started to bring up something else, revocations of citizenship.
Where does that fit into the Constitution?
Well, it sort of doesn't. That is, revocation of citizenship is possible for committing very, very, very serious federal crimes. There's a famous story about a guy known as the Man Without a Country.
1863, yeah.
It was based on a true case of a guy who had found to be disloyal to the United States and denied his citizenship after the Civil War was over and basically went around the world, could never come home again.
Yeah, they cut all references to the United States out of the newspapers that he got, and all of that went on for years. Right, yeah, he was an American citizen who was banished.
Absolutely. So in the modern era, we have the phenomenon of stateless people, particularly after World War II. The people whom we are deporting may very well end up as stateless people. That's the first place to start, because there's no guarantee the places we're deporting them, like, say, South Sudan, is going to offer them citizenship. If we were to revoke the citizenship of an American citizen, that person would end up as stateless unless some other country wants to offer them citizenship. And just to put this in perspective, let's mention the person with respect to whom Trump has talked about this the most, Rosie O'Donnell.
Yes, of late.
Donald
right.
Trump has said he is looking into, I quote, having the citizenship of Rosie O'Donnell revoked.
On what basis? Declared basis?
Saying bad things about him.
Which I suppose they would argue is contrary to the interests of the United States.
Well, that doesn't apply here. This is a citizen.
Okay.
I don't have a theory to explain why he thinks that this would be appropriate. It would have to be, he would have to assert that Rosie O'Donnell was guilty of something like treason. But the fact that, you know, there's an interesting and complex relationship, and I'm not sure any of us fully understand it, between Trump's dialogue on Truth Social and actions of the Trump administration. Sometimes they seem to follow directly from one to the other. Sometimes things are tried out on Truth Social and there's nothing happens with them. Sometimes there's a percolation period. I don't think, though, that it's utterly insignificant that at least rhetorically, Trump is starting to broaden the scope of his asserted authority to get rid of people to include citizens as well as non-citizens. Up until now, that has not happened. I mean, let's be clear. Trump has not imprisoned his political opponents. Trump has not rounded up large numbers of American citizens and tried to deport it, right? We have seen a lot of unpleasant things happen. One of the questionable things that Trump has been doing has been the practice of deliberately targeting blue states and blue cities for immigration enforcement actions. That's in the federal courts, but any injunction will no longer be effective because of Trump versus Casa, this recent case. Garcia, this guy who was deported, is now being tried on some really remarkable criminal charges.
I thought it was trafficking.
Well, it is, but what makes the charges so remarkable is the government's case presents a schedule that would involve, I think, sleeping one hour a day for weeks at a time, because it's just impossible. But leaving that aside, the government has said that if he is released, they'll deport him. Even though, right, right back where we started, without due process, without any showing of evidence and so on. So Could this expand to reach citizens? I think, you know, I think at that point the Supreme Court would stand up. I
always wonder where the red line is, exactly. Don't you, for Congress, for the Supreme Court?
You know, President Obama talked about red lines for chemical weapons.
That didn't work so well.
And then they weren't lines or they weren't red, one or the other. You know, what is really a red line? I don't know. I do think that this court is able to justify to itself what its members are able to justify to themselves, what they're doing on a kind of constitutional theory that says, well, look, all of this is executive business. These are all things that fall generally within the executive department's purview. You know, maybe it's okay. Locking people up for crimes and deporting them, that's an executive function. But if it were to reach the point of doing that with American citizens without trials, if there was a stream of habeas corpus petitions, remembering that the Supreme Court retains for itself the authority to issue universal injunctions, yeah, at that point, I think they would step forward. And I think, you know, effectively, that's a red line that the Trump administration doesn't want to cross, not only for that reason, but for political reasons. But make no mistake, we had mass deportations under Eisenhower. We had very large-scale deportations under Obama. In immigration circles, Obama was known as the deporter-in-chief.
Well, true, right?
Long had a program called expedited removal, which involves and lots of those took place without due process. And no one called Eisenhower or Obama a fascist. I mean, this is a long-standing practice we've had. We've never had a special army to carry it out. But even before, American citizens were occasionally swept up and were occasionally deported and occasionally found themselves dumped on the street in Mexico, calling their family friends and saying, what the hell do I do now? Occasionally. It could certainly happen in more significant numbers. Think of it like the dolphins that get caught in the fishing nets. The administration would say, gosh, we're sorry about those dolphins, but we're really just fishing for tuna.
Yeah. Good analogy. How much of this phenomenon is John Roberts, as the Chief Justice, responsible for?
I think a lot. Wild speculation here. I mean, you know, I'm guessing based on nothing. Obviously, the three liberal justices have been writing dissents about these. Even when there's an unsigned order, we didn't discuss the fact that most of this is being done on what's called the shadow docket.
Yeah, what is that?
That's the part of the Supreme Court's docket where they hear, for example, an appeal from an injunction, and they make a ruling. There's no briefs. Lawyers don't argue before the court. There's no opinion explaining the decision. There's usually no signature. The Roberts Court for years has been using, this is one of the radical things they've done, has been using the shadow docket to introduce very important constitutional doctrine with no explanation, no briefing by the parties, no arguments by lawyers, right?
They just say, oh, we were thinking about it, we decided this.
We went to the back room and here's a rule. There's a wonderful old Saturday Night Live sketch comparing a bill that becomes a law to an executive order. It's the old Schoolhouse Rock routine. I'm just a bill. I'll become a law someday. And then a guy comes out dressed up like a scroll paper and says, I'm an executive order. I just happen. The shadow docket just happens.
Uh-huh.
This year, we've seen dissenting justices writing fiery opinions.
Yes.
Against these unsigned orders, except for the CASA case, that's the case about the universal injunctions, all the other things I've been talking about have been done by unsigned orders that just say the injunction is lifted, the Trump administration can do what it wants with no explanation, no legal analysis, no opportunity for argumentation, no justification. So partly because of that, I have to speculate quite a lot here. I think there are a couple of the justices who are eager to uphold what Trump is doing across the board. I think, leaving aside, there are the three liberal justices who clearly are horrified. I think there are a couple, I think Alito and Thomas, let's just put it out there. I think Alito and Thomas are probably pretty eager to approve of most of, if not all of, the things that Trump is doing. I think the rest of them,
including Roberts,
have mixed feelings, and I think Roberts has a great deal of responsibility for persuading the others that the best strategy is to just not answer the question. That's a Roberts move. It's a classic Roberts move. Evading a tough issue, focusing more on protecting the institution than on the parties before them, forming a coalition of votes on the basis of something other than agreement on the fundamental issue. These are all really, really classic Roberts moves.
I have to ask a practical question here, I suppose. my first thought when I saw these, well, we're going to look at this later, was, oh, they must be the Supreme Court so overwhelmed that they just say, we've got to think about that later and address the more immediate question.
No, they've decided fewer cases this year than any year in their in modern history. The number of cases they hear and decide has gone down every year in the last, I don't have a number, but I think it's something of the last 12 or 15 years. And the cases that they are not deciding are absolutely the most urgent. Planes literally in the air. Now, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that this is not all the Supreme Court does. There have been important rulings this year on religious freedom. There have been a bunch of rulings this year that are significant. But they all really pale in importance compared to the challenge to the constitutional order and the fundamental challenge to the rule of law that is posed by the actions of the Trump administration.
Do we really see a clear pattern when we talk about liberal justice, conservative justice? Are they really that consistent across the board?
So many people like to point out, might like to argue that these are false distinctions. They'll say something like, oh, 90% or 80%, depends on the year. But, you know, more than 85% of all decisions are unanimous. That's misleading. I mean, that's not false, but it's misleading. Yes, there are clear patterns where issues of constitutional meaning are at stake. What do we think the Constitution means? Particularly if the stakes are high. Now, we use the words conservative and liberal, and this always makes my feet itch, because they're real terms, and constitutional conservative is a real thing, and a constitutional progressive is a real thing, but they don't track perfectly to policy liberals or partisan liberals and conservatives. It's a Venn diagram. There's considerable overlap, but they're not identical and coextensional. So, and that really goes back to my point that I think what's going on is that the conservative justices, who are genuinely conservative, while they may approve of some of the things that the Trump administration is doing, they may disapprove of others, mostly just don't want to answer the question. I think they might be, in fact, even unwilling to approve what the Trump administration is doing, for fear of diminishing their own legitimacy. And in some of these areas, it's likely that they would. I mentioned before that when an injunction is granted, one of the tests is likelihood of success on the merits. On a couple of occasions, the conservative justices have said, we think the Trump administration is likely to succeed on the merits. Now, you can't read too much into that. It hasn't happened yet, and it doesn't always come out that way. But I think it's clear that the conservatives are avoiding not only ruling against the Trump administration, but in some instances are avoiding ruling for the Trump administration. They're avoiding ruling at all. They want to allow this window of time in which the Trump administration can do whatever it wants. I called it a window of lawlessness, but of course, that's my perspective. But regardless, a window of permissiveness, let's say, or prerogative. And I don't think that it's as simple as, you know, they ultimately will have to strike everything down. I think the priority is just what it looks like. We just don't want to answer the question.
It's a fascinating look at the Supreme Court, a kind of court that we're not familiar with, passing on so many issues that seem to be major and in some cases urgent.
And not what this court has been like in the past either.
Howard Schwaber, always a pleasure, always enlightening.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun to be here.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you'll join me next time around for University of the Air on the News Network. Our engineer is Jeff Robbins, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio.